Let's say I have half an hour to spare. I pick up a book of poems or a work of fiction and I start reading. Can I be said to enter the realm of responsibility, which is to say the realm of ethics, at least in some sense of that rather problematic word? I don't mean in terms of the characters in a novel or a play who have their own ethical dilemmas and responsibilities to deal with, but in terms of the reader's own obligations towards the work. One perfectly reasonable answer would be that we clearly don't. We pick up a book freely and put it down again freely, and it's entirely up to us whether we read carefully or casually, from cover to cover, or jumping about indiscriminately. No one benefits apart from ourselves if we do the former. No one is harmed if we do the latter. If we convert our reading into a reading, questions of ethics, at least of a minimal kind, clearly do arise. If we offer orally or in writing an interpretation of the work, we can do this responsibly or irresponsibly, thereby benefiting or harming the author or the author's memory, and perhaps our own hearers and readers. The ethical stakes are usually not great, but they are real. However, for the moment, I want to concentrate on the act of reading itself, or what I've called in print somewhat clumsily, the act event of reading, since it's a curious blend of doing something and having something done to one. Although the reasons for hesitating to invoke ethics in a discussion of reading are undeniably well-founded, there are so many domains in which ethical questions are more pressing and more far-reaching, much traditional literary criticism and teaching of literature implies that reading does have an ethical function. To advance a particular reading or to advocate a particular strategy of reading, and often these are done simultaneously, at least by implication, is to make a claim about its value. This reading, or this type of reading, does fullest justice to the specificity and the worth of the work or works being addressed. Although responsibility is not a word that all such readers would employ in justifying their choices, few would disagree that there's some sense in which a good reading must be a responsible reading. Anyone making a case for irresponsible reading, and as we shall see, there could be reasons for doing so, would be using the term in the knowledge that it contradicts the norms of common sense.
We're going to adjust the mic. Could you move that maybe just a little higher up? Yeah.
Is that good? Does this mean half of you haven't heard a word yet? Sorry, I'm not going to start at the beginning again. But what does responsibility mean in this situation? Here's a well-known poem by Emily Dickinson. It's on your handout. As imperceptibly as grief, the summer lapsed away. Too imperceptible at last to seem like perfidy. A quietness distilled as twilight long begun, or nature spending with herself sequestered afternoon. The dusk drew earlier in, the morning foreign shone, a courteous yet harrowing grace as guest that would be gone. And thus, without a wing, or service of a keel, our summer made her light escape into the beautiful. Am I under an obligation to read these lines in any particular way? Obviously not. I can glance at the words, I can read them inattentively, I can even read them backwards if I want. If I didn't understand English, I couldn't read them at all and couldn't be blamed for this failure. What I want to argue, however, is that to read these lines as a work of literature is to be put under an obligation of a kind. Or, more accurately, and I'll return to this point, to find oneself already under an obligation. And I believe the word responsibility is a useful one to refer to that obligation, suggesting not so much a duty which binds the reader like a moral code, but a certain attitude or disposition and a certain practice or mode of behavior. In The Singularity of Literature, I sketched briefly some of the implications of using the term responsibility in describing what it is to read a text as a literary work. And there are, of course, many ways of reading any text, including those we would classify unproblematically as literature. Today I want to explore those implications a little further. If we think of responsibility in the strict sense of answerability or accountability, we have to ask, before whom or to whom is the reader responsible? Who does the reader have to answer to for his or her reading? There's no judge or court before whom I'll be held to account for dealing well or badly with a literary work. Of course, a reading in the other sense, a reading that's a writing, may well be put before judges who will pronounce their verdicts on it. Examiners, journal editors, the academic public. But I am, as I've said, concerned for the moment with the process of reading, not the spoken or written aftermath. To call such a reading responsible must mean that it's one which the reader would be willing to stand by, to be judged by, whether or not judging is ever likely to take place. In a similar sense, a responsible driver is one who's prepared to be judged by the highest standards. A responsible builder is one who would be willing to have his or her work assessed according to the strictest codes. But we mustn't overlook the ethical dimension of our use of this term. Responsible driving is not the same as skillful driving, though it depends on being able to drive skillfully. The implicit judgment is not about speed or elegance at the wheel, but about road safety. A skeptic will ask, isn't good reading, just like skillful driving, a matter not of ethics, but of expertise? Well, one way of approaching this question is by looking at the prepositions we might use. A crucial aspect of a driver's responsibility is not responsibility to, but responsibility for passengers, for other road users and pedestrians, for the wider community. Their lives or their well-being are in the driver's hands, quite literally. A responsible driver is therefore one who takes full account of the safety of others, with all that this entails. Thorough training, physical alertness, skillful handling, conscientious attention, careful anticipation. The responsible builder takes into account all those who will live in the house, if that's what it is, that's being built, as well as those who will look at it and those who will be affected by the choice of materials, site, and so on. The crucial issue here is always the question of others, or in the language of philosophical ethics, the other. So, what other is the literary reader responsible for? In the first place, the other could be said to be the text itself. Here we touch on one defining attribute of the literary work and the artwork more generally that I've discussed elsewhere. Literature, in the strictest sense, I've argued, is always characterized by a challenge to the habits and norms by which the reader relates to the world. It may be a minimal challenge, the highly familiar in slightly unfamiliar garb, or a frontal assault on our sensibilities or our linguistic expectations. But how can the reader be held responsible for the otherness of the literary work? What's important to acknowledge, I believe, is that otherness is not an inherent and unchanging property of the work. Literary history is in part the history of the changing way in which works present their challenge, some becoming unreadable, others becoming so readable as to cease to operate as literature. The reason why this happens is that readers alter, and otherness exists only as it's produced by a particular relation between a reader and a work. Otherness is always otherness too. It's not an intrinsic feature. A responsible reading, then, is one that recognizes, affirms, and sustains that otherness in a particular time and place, and for a particular time and place. A reading that glides over the work's challenges or converts otherness to sameness by imposing a familiar meaning on an unfamiliar one, or that disregards the context within which the work is being read, is responding irresponsibly. Emily Dickinson's poem is not hard to understand, yet it's full of strangeness. To do justice to the poem as we read is to experience that strangeness, which is not a matter of being just bemused or amazed by its departure from what we might expect, but of attempting to account for it. We register its otherness in the effort we have to make to adjust our own habits of thinking and feeling, and in the sense that despite all our efforts, we have not reduced alterity completely to sameness. This is different from, say, encountering an unfamiliar word in a text, looking it up, and then finding the sentence in question has become perfectly comprehensible. Let's take the first four lines, and I'm not remember offering a reading of the poem, just talking about what it might be like to read it, particularly as a first-time reader. The first surprise is that the opening simile equates the summer with grief, an equation that seems an affront to our common understanding. The ground of their likeness is the manner in which they both lapse away, itself an unusual phrase. They do it imperceptibly. With a little thought, we can understand the logic of those first four lines. Grief for a lost loved one does not disappear overnight so that we can observe its passing. Rather, it lessens so gradually that we're not aware of its going. A diminishment of grief would feel like a betrayal of the one we're mourning, and we're only spared that sense of betrayal by the imperceptibility of the process. In the case of the summer, however, the perfidy that we would otherwise feel is not our own, but that of the season itself, making the simile a far from simple one. However fully we're able to explain the comparison, the contrast between these two words, and the distinct affective universe each conjures up, is never entirely banished. So when we come to read the poem again, it's likely to retain a trace of that power to disconcert. I could go through the poem's surprises like this, the ambiguous grammar of distilled and long begun, the striking idea of a distilled quietness, or of nature as a solitary individual, or of the morning as an embarrassed guest, confident that most of them would be registered as surprises by other readers as well. Had Dickinson published the poem immediately after she had written it, it would have surprised readers of the time even more, and perhaps in different ways. One feature of the poem that's probably always carried a charge of surprise is the final word. It seems to have either too much or too little meaning, a confident Platonism or a desperate nominalism. Is it an appeal to memory, to the aesthetic, to a principle of evanescence? A responsible reading keeps all these in play, acknowledging the resistance of such multiplicity of suggestion to the demands of logic and rationality. Another aspect of a reading that does justice to a work's otherness is that it treats the work not as an object, but as an event. In the case of a poem, this means reading it aloud, or at least in real time, in one's head, or of course hearing someone else read it. Only then can its deployment of rhythm, its patterning of sound, its linear progression of expectation and satisfaction, tension and release, be fully experienced. Crucial to the way the reader registers the poem, or the poem registers upon the reader, is its rhythmic movement. Responding to the movement of Dickinson's poem doesn't require any specialized knowledge of formal poetic structures. The English-speaking reader, who has encountered nursery rhymes, popular songs, advertising jingles, ballads, and/or rap, will slip immediately and unself-consciously into the regular rhythm, what I've called the 4x4 meter, four groups of four beats, repeated in this case four times. The poem isn't laid out in quatrains, but four-line units are evident in the rhythmic pattern, the rhymes, and the syntax. The first two lines announce the unmistakable rhythm of the hymn book's common measure, which is also the basis of the familiar ballad meter, lines of four, three, four, and three beats, the fourth beat of the shorter lines being virtual rather than realized. As imperceptibly as grief, the summer lapsed away. There's a missing beat, as it were, at the end of that second line. But the quatrains that follow vary this by moving into what the hymn books call short measure, in which the first line too has only three realized beats. A quietness distilled as twilight long begun. That unexpected silence after three beats contributes to the quietness evoked by the line. But what I want to stress is that we don't have to be aware of the metrical structure that produces this experience in order for it to do its work. A responsible reading then gives itself over to this rhythm, not so as to override the delicate variations of each line, but to experience the poem as an event given momentum and rhythmic shape through its engagement with deeply rooted habits of the body. The event of the poem is also, of course, the unfolding of its meanings, or its argument, or its narrative, all carried by that rhythm. In the case of prose, the articulation of individual words and the onward drive of rhythm may be less important to the sense of the work as an event, but a responsible reading will be alert to narrative, character development, dialogue, the creation and resolution of enigmas, and many other features that take place as the work unfolds in time. This isn't to say that the visual dimension of literary works is irrelevant. Looking is as much an event as listening, and reading something aloud on the page combines the two. Part of the event of Dickinson's poem is responding to those, if you're encountering it for the first time, strange dashes, the uppercase letters, the lack of additional spaces between the quatrains, none of which would be evident if we only heard it. Treating a work as an event means finding in that event the value of the work, not in anything to be learnt or deduced from it. Certainly we can and often do learn from works of literature, but to that extent we're treating them as if they were something other than literature. Dickinson's poem, we might want to say, is about the experience of loss, specifically the loss of the beauty of summer as the year turns to autumn, but perhaps by analogy, other losses as well. About, however, is an inappropriate preposition. It suggests that the poem's purpose is to provide information. The event of the poem involves the reader in an experience that's somehow connected with the experience of loss, but it isn't actually that experience. We don't feel we're losing something as we read the poem. What happens can perhaps only be expressed metaphorically. The poem stages loss and stages the emotions aroused by loss. It does this not by naming those emotions, but by a vivid representation of seasonal transition that appeals to our shared store of affective responses. When a literary work moves us to tears or to laughter, it's through the power of its stagings, not through the direct apprehension of reality. If we shed tears at Cordelia's death, they're very different from the tears we shed at the death of a friend, though their origins aren't entirely foreign to one another. Two further characteristics of the literary work operate in conjunction with its otherness. In responding to Dickinson's poem, we're registering not just its challenge to our familiar ways of thinking, but what I've called its singularity. It has an identity that marks it off from every other literary work, an identity that's not fixed, because what it is defined against, what it is defined against changes constantly, but nevertheless enables us to say that this is the same poem that its first readers encountered. And we also respond to the work's inventiveness. When Dickinson wrote, as imperceptibly as grief, the summer lapsed away, she brought into being a complex of idea, image, and affect that introduced something hitherto unknown into the world. She produced a pair of lines that were not only unlike any others that had been written, but which expanded the reach of the language itself. This quality of inventiveness, like the singularity and otherness of the lines, remains potent today, as if in reading the poem, and even in rereading it several times, we were experiencing an echo of its original explosion onto the 19th century American scene. Familiar though it has not been wholly accommodated within our habitual patterns of thought and feeling. In speaking of Dickinson's act or active end of bringing the poem into being, I've introduced the issue of the writer's inventiveness, not just the poem's. And this adds a further dimension to the responsibility of the reader. There's a sense in which our responsibility is not just to the work, but to its author, even if we know nothing about that person or persons. The inventiveness of As Imperceptibly as Grief is Emily Dickinson's. She was the one who achieved its singularity, who engaged with otherness. In finding ourselves responsible for these qualities of the poem, we find we have a relation to the author as well. It's the author's achievement in creating something new out of the formal and substantial materials available to her in her time and place, what Henry Statton has called techne, to which we're attempting to do justice in our reading. It's not, I should stress, a matter of responsibility to the historical individual, but to her singular inventiveness manifested in the poem. Responsibility for the other is a phrase associated, above all, with the ethical philosophy of Immanuel Levinas, and I've argued elsewhere, although Levinas would not have accepted this extrapolation, that some of the terms he provides are useful in thinking about our responsibility as readers of literary works. In particular, we can draw on Levinas's insistence that responsibility is not something we choose to take on, but something we find ourselves already seized by. In fact, we only come into existence as fully human subjects through that responsibility. Thus, I would argue that we're constituted as literary readers by the responsibility for the work that imposes itself upon us. We can refuse that responsibility, read rapidly or rigidly or carelessly, but doing so will not erase it. It's Levinas, too, who stresses that we're responsible for the other, ultimately for the other's survival. And similarly, it's our readings that keep literary works alive. Our responsibility is to affirm what is singular, inventive, and other in the work, experienced as an event, and thus conserve it and pass it on. Now, it may sound as if I'm advocating a reading of the literary work as nothing but words on the page, divorced from any cultural, social, or economic context. This is because I've been imagining a reader coming to the poem without any background knowledge. But a responsible reading of the words on the page can't avoid attending to the strands that tie them to the world they arose from, nor for that matter the associations they evoke in the world that surrounds and informs the reader. Readings improve as familiarity with the author grows. Those uppercase letters don't seem quite so locally functional when you've read a couple of hundred of Dickinson's poems. A question arises at this point, however. Is a truly responsible reading one that has exhausted all the possible avenues of research that could throw light on its meanings, its contexts, its origins, its allusions? Is anything that falls short of this ideal to be deemed failing in its responsibility? Levinas helps us again here. For him, the demands made by responsibility for the other are infinite. But this does not mean that a responsible response is impossible. That first time reading, without any background knowledge or familiarity with Dickinson's work, can be responsible if it's attentive and open to the event of the poem. Ignorance can produce bad readings, but if the reader is excusably ignorant about a particular point, this can't be termed irresponsibility. At the same time, if there's an opportunity for further exploration of the poem's content and context, a responsible reading would be one that takes this further step. And as Levinas insists, there's no determinate end to the possibilities that open up. What if we move from reading to writing, to a reading of the poem, for, say, a student paper or a published article? The same responsibility clearly applies, but there's now the added responsibility of creating a verbal work that does justice to the original. It can't simply repeat the original, but every word that's added is necessarily some kind of deviation. However, there are different kinds of unfaithfulness. The responsible reading finds a way of being unfaithful that nevertheless affirms the singularity of the work. Hence, it involves irresponsibility of a kind, a risk, a plunge into the unknown, just as the original act of creation did. There can be no recipe to fall back on, since to affirm singularity requires that one produce an answering singularity. In approaching this paradoxical issue, Jacques Derrida uses the analogy of the signature and the countersignature, which may be worth recalling here. When I sign a document, I testify that I'm physically present here and now, and that I approve what I've signed, and I promise to acknowledge that presence and that approval at any future date. A signature therefore represents that unique event. But as Derrida points out, simply to write one's name is not to sign. My signature will only work as it's supposed to if it's at once unique and recognizable. To be unique is to be different each time. If on inspection a signature turns out to have been produced by a rubber stamp, it fails, since it no longer testifies to the presence of the signer. But to be recognizable is to be repeated. A signature that's different, too different, from the same individual's other signatures will fail. Hence the paradox of the signature. To function, it has to be both the same and different. The signature of Joyce's Ulysses, say, is that which makes it unique among literary works, but also those many features it shares with other works by Joyce and by other authors. If it were wholly unique, it would be completely unreadable, as there would be no codes and conventions by which to read it. If it were wholly a repetition of other works, no one would bother to read it. A responsible reading of Ulysses is one that does justice to both these dimensions. It's also important to note that central to the identity of the signature is its form. Merely repeating the content in the sense of the name is not sufficient. It has to be a formally recognizable repetition, while not being a complete repetition. Derrida uses another term, one that complicates the picture, though. He draws on the notion of the countersignature, a signature that affirms another signature, which would otherwise remain invalid, unwitnessed, a possible forgery. The countersignature, possessing exactly the same paradoxical properties as the signature, constitutes the first signature as a signature and not just as a written name or as a rubber stamp. And it will probably be evident that both signature and countersignature are events rather than simply objects. Perhaps we should talk rather about signings. The reader who does justice to the literary work countersigns its signature, affirms its uniqueness and identity by its own uniqueness and identity. In fact, you might say that the work's uniqueness and identity do not exist as such until responded to by readers in this way. The implication, of course, is that all good readings are different, though all find ways of responding to the work's singularity. Among the many possible ways of countersigning a work's signature, of responding responsibly to the event of its singularity, is to give a temporal account of one's own experience of reading. Such a process of writing is, of course, a staged narrative, reflecting many readings and rereadings, but it allows one to convey something of the work's own stagings of human concerns and emotions. I want to spend the rest of this talk tracing my own response to a literary text to exemplify what I take to be some elements of a responsible reading. I also want to stress that in doing so, one has an obligation to acknowledge the particularity of the situation within which one encounters the work of literature, rather than attempting to disguise that particularity behind universalizing claims. One's responsibility as a reader is not only with regard to the work and its author, but to one's own place and time, one's past, and the future one hopes for. The work I've chosen is a poem by Paul Muldoon entitled The Loaf. It's on the other side of the handout. I first read this poem as I worked my way through the collection in which it appeared in 2002, Moist Sand and Gravel, and of course it triggered associations with many other poems by Muldoon and others. But for the purposes of this exercise, I'll leave those echoes and allusions out of consideration. Though any of you who know either Muldoon's poetry or his criticism will know that that's to read in a very un-Muldoonian way. I must emphasize that this isn't meant to be a blueprint for poetic commentary, just my way, for the present moment, of trying to convey what happens when I read and enjoy and find myself moved by this poem.
The loaf. When I put my finger into the hole, they've cut for a dimmer switch in a wall of plaster, stiffened with horse hair. It seems I've scratched a 200-year-old itch with a pink and a pink and a pinky pick. When I put my ear to the hole, I'm suddenly aware of spades and shovels turning up the game all the way from Raritan to the Delaware with a clink and a clink and a clinky click. When I put my nose to the hole, I smell the floodplain of the canal after a hurricane, and the spots of green grass where thousands of Irish have lain, with a stink and a stink and a stinky stink. When I put my eye to the hole, I see one holding horse dung to the rain, in the hope, indeed, of washing out a few whole ears of grain, with a wink and a wink and a winky wink. And when I do at last succeed in putting my mouth to the horsehair-fringed niche, I can taste the small loaf of bread he baked from that whole seed, with a link and a link and a linky link.
Thank you, Paul. You can see the website where you can actually watch Paul Muldoon reading that poem as well as hear him on the handout. I start with the title. The loaf doesn't give much away. I hold it suspended to be filled out with meaning as the poem proceeds. When I put my finger to the hole they've cut for a dimmer switch, I find I'm listening to a personal voice, and a very direct one at that. Nothing poetic or tricksy about this language. The anonymous they is immediately understandable as the middle class employer's way of referring to the work people he, let's assume a male speaker, has employed. And the dimmer switch, a sure sign of contemporary bourgeois living, a home being upgraded. The line is a rhythmic whole, stresses spaced out by one, two, or three unstressed syllables, an easy movement which contributes to its relaxed tone. It's a calm beginning. Curiosity implicit in the gesture described, not agitated or anxious, a natural action when seeing for the first time, perhaps, the material inside the walls of one's house. When I put my finger to the hole they've cut for a dimmer switch in a wall of plaster stiffened with horsehair. The second line has the same matter-of-fact tone and evenly spaced rhythm, and the absence of an uppercase initial in its first word contributes to its unpoetic cast. Though I take in the information quite greedily, since I'm still trying to get my bearings. Stiffened with horsehair? How long ago were houses built with horsehair in the walls? At this stage, I'm only guessing. The sentence still hasn't reached its verb, but now it arrives. When I put my finger to the hole they've cut for a dimmer switch, in a wall of plaster stiffened with horsehair, it seems I've scratched a 200-year-old itch. Here's an answer to my earlier question. Horsehair stiffened plaster might be found in a 200-year-old house. Does it matter that I know that part of Paul Muldoon's house is over 200 years old? It's not knowledge I can erase from my consciousness, though I wouldn't claim it's essential to reading the poem. The rhythm stutters a little on the hyphenated adjective, putting additional weight onto the final stressed word, 200-year-old itch. But why does touching the ancient exposed plaster seem like scratching an itch? Is the rhyme already calling the shots at this point? A feeling that Muldoon's highly formal poetry sometimes courts? An enigma, as Barthes would say, that I read on to solve. The resolution is not, however, immediately forthcoming. Instead, I encounter something quite unexpected. With a pink and a pink and a pinky pick. It's here that the poem, hitherto an intriguing but not particularly remarkable personal anecdote, matter-of-factly related, carries me into unfamiliar territory. Otherness confronts me and obliges me to respond. The first-person intimacy is gone, and language itself, or the tradition of popular verse, or the archaic domain of the child, seems to be speaking or even singing the words. Suddenly sound, which had not been particularly foregrounded in the previous lines, becomes central to my experience. A regular anapestic rhythm up to the final word, where the triple movement gives way to duple, and at the same time a consonant is dropped to transform pink to pick. I recognize the signs of a traditional refrain, of say a work song or a children's chant, in the beginning with on with a, the tendency towards nonsense, the repetitions, and these are confirmed in print by the use of italics. It's as if history is speaking through this archaic form. We seem to have moved 200 years back in poetic time as well. Usually in nonsense refrains, however, with a hey and a ho and a hey nonny no, there's no point in looking for meaning. But in this refrain, some sense pushes through the opacity of the line. A pinky is a finger, the little one usually, so that takes me back to the first line. A pinky pick could be the action described there. But pink, a color, a flower, though no doubt an ingenious enough critic could find justifications for these meanings, this may be an example of associations that a responsible reading needs to resist. The only relevant association that comes to my mind is with the verb to pink, to make holes. The meanings hover indistinctly around the line, and I read on. The opening of the next stanza tells me immediately that a pattern is being set up. Finger is replaced by ear, touch by hearing. When I put my ear to the hole, I'm suddenly aware of spades and shovels turning up the gain. Another pattern is making itself known in the rhyme. Aware remembers horsehair. Spades and shovels retroactively invites me to find another meaning in pick. And then I reach turning up the gain and I'm stumped, and I just have to move on. Being willing to move on is crucial to making the most of Muldoon, who provides far more than any single reading requires. Cheerfully skipping uninterpretable words is a strategy I first learned in coping with Finnegan's Wake. Later, though, I use the online OED to discover that a gain is, among other things I know already, a transverse channel made in the side of an underground railway. Well, that's something that would be made by spades and shovels, but it seems a bit of a stretch. So I Google the phrase, thank goodness for Google, and at once all is clear. When adjusting an electric guitar, you turn up the gain until the amplification is correct. Here my knowledge, which many readers wouldn't share, that Muldoon is a keen player of the electric guitar, though you can see plenty of evidence of this on his personal website, comes irresistibly to confirm the rightness of this interpretation. Putting his ear to the hole, our house owner hears spades and shovels increasing the volume of sound all the way from Raritan to the Delaware. Again, my own history comes to my aid. I lived for many years not far from the Raritan River and Raritan Township and walked along parts of the Raritan and Delaware Canal. Otherwise, I might have had to have recourse to Google again. I also know that Muldoon's house overlooks the canal. Other readers might have to move on without making much of these proper names. A canal, then, and the sound of the laborers who dug it. But why does a hole in the wall trigger this particular hallucination or mental leap? Once more, the question remains unanswered as the refrain in a new form takes over, with a clink and a clink and a clinky click. It's not an exact duplication, but all the words either repeat or rhyme with the first version of the refrain. This time, a conventional onomatopoeia helps to make sound dominant, and it's easy to connect click, clink, with spades and shovels. Once again, the end disappears in the final word, creating an effect whose formal significance is now becoming evident. One can read click in many ways, and there's a temptation to suggest a clever interpretation. But what actually happens in reading that word? The parallel with the first refrain is confirmed, and the resonance of the nasal element in clink disappears, giving the line something like a diminished close. Click, of course, is another traditional onomatopoeic word, but with a different range of suggestiveness than clink. Perhaps that's all that matters, not the possible reference to cameras or misfiring guns or light switches that might be proposed by a reader scrutinizing the poem as an object to be exhaustively analyzed. I'm now able to predict some of what remains. Seeing the poem on the page, I notice that there are five stanzas, and I can guess the reason. I move on to the next sense organ. When I put my nose to the hole, I smell the floodplain of the canal after a hurricane. The reader who was puzzled by Raritan and Delaware now gets an explanation as violence enters the poem with the storm and the flooded canal. But it's the next line that brings me to what I think is the emotional center of the poem. And the spots of green grass where thousands of Irish have lain. A reader who didn't know that Muldoon was himself an Irish immigrant to New Jersey, albeit a prosperous writer rather than an indigent navvy, would miss the personal charge here, but would understand the point that the canal was the product of Irish immigrant labor. Here is the 200-year-old itch waiting to be scratched. The story of the Irish workers in the early 19th century giving their lives to the commercial interest of American industrialists. I say giving their lives because the greenness of the spots of grass and the word lane irresistibly suggest the many deaths such workers suffered. Even if thousands seems an exaggeration. But why shouldn't the poem at this point expand to take in all the Irish laborers who died in the United States on such projects? If I decide to take advantage of Google again, I quickly find out that in the 1830s, 4,000 Irish immigrants were hired to dig the Raritan and Delaware Canal with picks and shovels, and that during the construction, an epidemic of cholera broke out, as a result of which dozens of men were buried along the banks. Spots of green. This is the smell that carries across 200 years, mingled with the stench of the flood. As I read the stanza, I register the three rhyme words. Not only do plain and lane echo gain from the previous stanza, I've realized by now that the non-refrain part of the poem is in terza rima, but hurricane, certainly in Muldoon's pronunciation, makes it a triplet, a kind of central sonic clustering at this crucial juncture before the rhyme returns to its alternating pattern. The refrain almost writes itself now, as though it were the product less of a human intention than some non-human power. Rhyme's combination of the arbitrary and the meaningful has been extended to a whole line. It would be enough to be given the letters ST to be able to generate the entire refrain, with a stink and a stink and a stinky stick. Although the rhythm of the cheerful jingle is still there, the content moves in another direction, towards rotting flotsam and decomposing corpses. Again, the last compound enacts a transition, and again the meanings of the last word are potentially wide-ranging, though not necessarily all relevant. The suggestion I find I can't banish is the stickiness of putrefaction. Thinking I've understood the logic of the poem, I expect the fourth sense to be taste, making possible a climax on vision. I'm wrong, though. What comes next is an invitation to look across two centuries to a scene of painful poverty. When I put my eye to the hole, I see one holding horse dung to the rain, in the hope, indeed, indeed, of washing out a few whole ears of grain. It's a scene that's hard to believe. Were men really driven to this extreme? That, indeed, indeed, insists that they did, and I have to trust the poet. Trust is an important component of reading poetry or reading literature responsibly. Were I examining the poem for things to say about it in the conventional vocabulary of practical criticism, governed by the imperative to say something about form, I might draw attention to the alliteration and assonance in the series whole, holding, horse, and hope, the exact puns on hole and hole, I and I. Listening to the poem as it unfolds, however, these seem to me important only as part of the natural repetitiveness of speech, a sign not of carefully fashioned language, but of spontaneous utterance. Then the refrain, appropriate to the sense organ of the stanza, but taking the poem even further into the realms of nonsense, of children's rhymes, of rhythm and repetition as a bodily phenomenon, of language dissolving into chanted sound, with a wink and a wink and a winky wick. This is perhaps the riskiest moment in the poem, the furthest departure from the inseparability of language from mature human feeling many of us were taught to value by F.R. Leavis. It's as if the machinery of the poem has taken over entirely, for what meaning can winky wick have? Reading the poem on the page, I notice the IE ending of winky, which suggests a noun like pinky rather than an adjective like clinky or stinky. But winky is not to be found in the OED, and Google, though I have to say it throws up some fascinating material, is not of much help. Wee Willie Winky or Kipling's story of that name don't seem relevant, though no doubt an ingenious connection could be drawn by the resourceful critic. Yet the sound pattern remains compelling, that stark plosive shutting down the line after the repeated nasalized endings of all the previous stressed syllables. Now I move expectantly to the resolution. Even if I'm listening to the poem, I'm well aware that this is the final stanza, the fifth sense, and surely the least likely as a way of making contact with ancient masonry. When gives way to and when. And when I do at last succeed in putting my mouth to the horsehair-fringed niche, tasting the ancient plaster requires, not surprisingly, considerable willpower when I at last succeed. But the poem and the Irishman it commemorates demand this act of communication and communion, this culminating kiss, which we might even read as cunnilingus. The successive stresses and clotted consonants of the phrase, horsehair fringed niche, slow down the line, and I wonder if it's an example of the over-ingenuity of which I've been rather critical, to feel that the reader is being made conscious of his or her own mouth at this point. The terza rima pattern circles back to the rhyme of the first stanza, niche containing within itself the historic itch that we began with. The next line finally solves the puzzle of the title. I can taste the small loaf of bread he baked from that whole seed. A fairy tale ending, perhaps, a tiny triumph in the face of adversity, starvation fended off for one more day, but also a painful close-up from a chapter in the linked history of Ireland and America, conveyed by linking the past and the present through a quotidian object and compelling poetry. Those links are referred to in what is almost the poem's last word, with a link and a link and a linky lick. Not quite the last word because of that dropped N which we've seen coming from the start of the line. Up to now, this last syllable of the refrain has always produced a diminution of sense, but this time it comes as a climax. Closing the poem, it closes the physical gap between the speaker and the material substance he's exploring through the senses. By putting his tongue to crumbling plaster, he seals a bond between himself and those other Irishmen who made a home of sorts in this place. I've been speaking as if the experience of the poem was a single, continuous, linear event, followed perhaps by a little bit of research, but of course it doesn't happen like that. Any reading is characterized by discontinuities, reversals, interruptions, repetitions. I read over lines I don't grasp or that I want to savor. I come back to the poem in a different mood or with different knowledge. I keep bits of it in my head that I can revisit without needing a text in front of me. All I've tried to do here is imagine in simplified form the event of the poem as it might take place for me and to convey something of that experience to you. I've tried to accept my responsibility for the poem, for its singular insistence on the inseparability of form and content, language and human history, and for Muldoon as creator of the poem. I've tried, that is, to countersign its signature. That it remains teasing or even opaque in places is not necessarily a sign of failure. I see my responsibility as being to attempt to understand the poem as fully as I can, and at the same time to draw attention to those places where, for me, interpretation meets resistance. I've done my best to convert the other to the same, but responsible reading of a literary work, unlike other kinds of reading, also entails leaving the other as other.